we go. Y'all ready for this? The Bell and Pollack Legal Show. Gary Bell, Brad Pollack. Our law firm is Bell and Pollack. We are injury attorneys, but for this show, we're here for you to answer your questions on any legal subject and solve your problems on any legal subject. Doesn't matter if it's an injury subject or not. And don't forget, 2 weeks from today, October 14th, we're going to be debuting our new injury show on KOA. We'll still have this show, so this show's not going to go anywhere. But we're going to do a brand new one-hour injury show every Saturday morning on KOA, and we're going to cover a lot of interesting topics, and we're going to answer questions. So that's KOA, 10 o'clock in the morning. That's 8:50 a.m. Starting October 14th. That's the launch date of our new show. And Brad and I want to talk just a little bit about Equifax here and the law concerning Equifax and the lawsuits and what's involved in those lawsuits with regard to Equifax, because it is a hot topic. And there's a lot of class action lawsuits filed, and everybody says, well, there's class action lawsuits. They want millions of dollars. They want this. They want that. They want this. When you break it down, Brad, what do you really have to look at? What does an individual plaintiff, a claimant, have to prove? You know, all these people, millions of people's private information, birthdays, social security numbers, et cetera, was stolen, and somebody has it, and so now they're filing a lawsuit, but what do you got to show?
Well, that's a big problem, because you have to show injury, and you have to show that you're damaged, and you have to show that the people who got your information are using it for something or for some purpose or in some way that's going to cause harm to you. And you've got to show, it's not going to be even good enough, really, probably will not be good enough to even say, well, here's where the breach occurred, and here's where somebody was using my credit information or was using information in another state to get a hotel room or to buy gas or to buy objects or items, because they're going to turn around and they're going to say, well, how do you know it was caused by the breach from Equifax?
And you have to prove it was caused by the breach.
That's
right.
You
have to hook it up. You have to connect the dots. You can't just say it. You've got to prove it.
That's right. So they're going to be saying, hey, what, you know, how do you know it was that they got the information from the Equifax breach? And then you've got the next step, because then I think Equifax is going to look at you. And for everybody out there, pay attention to this. They're going to look at you and they're going to say, okay, you knew about the breach. What did you do to try to stop the damages from occurring?
Right, and people are going to say, you got to be kidding me. They're going to blame me. Yes, they're going to blame you, just like they do in car accidents, just like they do in truck accidents. They're going to blame you. Just like when you've been rear-ended, they're going to blame you.
That's right. So they're going to say, did you get into credit monitoring? Did you have your credit frozen? Did you take advantage of what Equifax has offered? Now, I think Equifax, you know, this will be left to the people doing the class action lawsuits and maybe some of the states or cities who are suing Equifax for breaching certain laws that they were supposed to report this earlier. But I think Equifax might have made a mistake when they said, look, we'll do credit monitoring, we'll close down your credit, or we'll freeze your credit for you. But to do so, you have to agree that if you want to sue us, you have to do it through arbitration and give up certain rights.
Right.
Because, you know, that's giving up rights to get to be able to take those actions. But did you call any other credit monitoring groups? Did you call anybody else? Did you get in touch with anybody to try to make sure that you would not be damaged from the breach and from of duty of care that Equifax exercised?
Right. I kind of liken it to you go through an intersection in your car, somebody runs a red light, almost hits you, almost, but does not. And you go, wow, whew. I mean, can you maintain a claim for that? Because they did something wrong. So what did they cause? There's your causation issue. What did they cause? What were your damages? Nothing. No damages. They committed a wrongful act. They committed a part of a tortious act. And they were wrong, but they didn't cause any damages. And we got some more to talk about on this Equifax, because we're talking about discovery. But joining us live right now is Martin. Good morning, Martin. How are you?
Oh, hi, guys.
It's good to hear from you,
Martin. What's going on?
What's going on, buddy?
Hey, I've got some questions regarding promissory estoppel and about how people make false promises to other people which they rely on. And I guess what the legal doctrine is, what, promissory estoppel?
Right. Well, it is. There's got to be some kind of relationship before it can just be a promise. You understand that?
For example, I noticed a lot of the TV court shows like Judge Judy and the like. A lot of people come up and say, well, he said this, and I relied on it, and now he's claiming there was never a promise or any agreement made, etc. And is that kind of, those a lot of the time they're oral. And how tough is it to bring a cause of action based on promissory estoppel?
Well, it's tough to do, but we've done it before. But so it's a derivative of the legal concept of the law of contracts. Contracts, you have an agreement between two people, etc. So we have written contract, oral contract, etc. But so the next step down was you don't have a formal contract, but they were talking to you and they made certain promises which induced you to do something. For example, you're working at company ABC, Martin, and I want to hire you. And I say, if you come over here, quit your job, come over here, we'll pay you X dollars, etc. And you quit.
They induce you.
They induce you. And you take action to your detriment. You quit your job. And now you come over here. And that is an example.
Right. You're talking about what we call a quasi-contract. It's some type of relationship that exists that has caused you to do something based on a promise or representation that somebody's going to do something in return. And the reason I talk about the relationship, Martin, is if you and I are sitting at the bar one night and having a few drinks and we say, let's go fishing tomorrow, and I say, yeah, I'll pick you up at 7 in the morning to go fishing, and you call in sick from your job and miss your day's pay, and then I don't show up to pick you up and I go to work and you miss out on a day's worth of pay, I doubt very much you're going to be able to sue me for promissory estoppel saying I was going to pick you up and go fishing together.
Yeah, but that's pretty lightweight then.
That's very lightweight. So if you have significant detriment damage, like you quit your job in my example, then the doctrine is alive and well.
Right, and then just the opposite. If I induce you to quit your job to come to work for me with a statement. Now, you know, a lot of this is being able to prove it. All right, can you prove the quasi-contract? Can you prove the promise that was made? Can you prove the representation that was made?
Well, that's kind of a high threshold in some circumstances.
Oh.
Well, it is, but let's take another example. The leading case in Colorado is Keenan versus Continental Airlines. He was a pilot. Keenan was a pilot. And so they fired him, et cetera. And so he said that the employee manual, the handbook, was either A, a contract, or B, promises under the promissory estoppel doctrine. I relied on them to my detriment. And so that was an instance where he was alleging that.
That case that's been cited a lot.
Well, yeah, it is cited a lot, but the court held that the employee manual and the handbook was a contract. And that's why you see in every employee handbook these days that this document does not constitute a contract, expressed or implied, and you cannot rely on anything in this document, et cetera, et cetera.
But it's documented in the employee handbook, so there's some basis to rely on because of the documentation via the handbook.
Correct.
But say in an oral context, then that becomes a lot tougher, doesn't it?
It does, but put yourself in the position of the judge. Martin, you say you quit your job because Gary promised you a new job over here, you quit your job. So I'm the judge. I'm going to say, who do I believe? Did this promise really exist? In my mind, I'm saying something caused Martin to quit his job and come over here. Something did. What was that something?
Yeah, he just didn't wake up in the morning and just say, I'm going to quit my job. In other words, the circumstances lend itself.
Exactly.
And that's the hard part. So, you know, normally something like this comes out of maybe a letter of intent, maybe negotiations that are going on over letter of intent, maybe negotiations that are going on over a contract where parts of the contract are being expanded to include other terms and other provisions that cause people to act, but the paperwork doesn't get done or doesn't get executed. Somebody started down the road towards completing a contract or an agreement, and the paperwork's not done yet, and then somebody backs out.
Good points. You know, sometimes circumstantial evidence is the most powerful evidence
to prove promissory estoppel and recovery.
That's exactly right.
You have to have tangible damages.
You've got to have tangible damages. You've got to rely to your detriment, your legal detriment. Boy, but you're right. You're all over this concept. Good job.
Well, thanks, guys.
Hey, Martin, thanks for the call.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, you're listening to the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We were talking about Equifax. Right after the break, we're going to come back to Equifax and talk about discovery, because you get discovery, you get to look at certain documents in lawsuits, you get to take depositions, and part of the discovery these plaintiffs are going to go after is when these Equifax officials knew it, there was a breach in March, they didn't tell anybody, they sold their stock, and they're going to say that's not relevant to whether or not you've been damaged on your credit. So we're going to cover that on the other side of the break. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. morning. Welcome back to the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We have offices in Greenwood Village, Denver, and Steamboat Springs, and we do cases all over the state of Colorado, as you know. But for this show, we're here to answer your questions on any legal subject. You can call us anytime at 303-713-8255. 713-8255. In the mountains, you can call us at 970-457-1009. 2 weeks from today, we're going to launch a new show. The show will still be around, still the same hour, same station, so don't go anywhere. But on KOA, the sister station here, 8:50 a.m. at 10 o'clock in the morning, we're going to launch our new one-hour injury show that's going to be a pure injury show. We're going to discuss all the ins and outs, everything you wanted to know about insurance companies, everything you want to know how they try to beat your claim, how they try to defeat you, what happens behind the scenes, how do they really adjust claims, what do you need to do, what you should you do, what do you need to know? And that just scratches the surface. We're going to get into the details of how you do injury claims and what you really, really, really need to know. Doesn't matter if it's a truck accident, car accident, motorcycle accident, trauma suffered, doesn't matter. It's going to apply. All right, we're talking about Equifax on the top of the show, Brad. So they file a lawsuit. When you file a lawsuit, you get to engage in what's called discovery. You get to request documents. You get to ask questions, written questions. You get to take depositions, oral questions, under oath. And so you know they're going to go after this. When did you know this? Give us the documents. Give us the emails. Give us all the communications when the breach first occurred and why you didn't disclose it to anybody and when you sold your stock and you made a lot of money and nobody else knew that was happening. And so if they'd known it, the stock price would have dropped. And they're going to say, Equifax is going to say, it's totally irrelevant to whether or not you got your credit stolen. And by the way, you can't prove that your credit being stolen caused you any harm.
Well, yes. And once again, that's going to be a situation where it's going to be talking about two different trains that are passing in the night on this type of thing. Because, you know, Equifax is going to be looking, saying, yeah, we may have a lot of security problems. We may have some problems that maybe some of the regulatory agencies and some of the criminal courts are going to be interested in seeing that, making sure it doesn't happen. But as far as all you consumers, it really doesn't matter to you, because yes, that information is stolen, but, and yes, that information is out there, but watch how fast Equifax is going to say, oh, your Social Security is out there, to every number is out there to everybody anyway. Everybody has it. It's easy to get. And they're, like Gary said, they're going to be looking and saying, you try and do the discovery against us to find out what we did wrong. You're never going to have enough money and time for what your injuries are. No lawyer is going to pick it up. So it's got to be a class action suit. But then when the class action suit comes on, it's going to be right back to the same thing. They're going to say, well, show us that your individual plaintiffs or your individuals were hurt, and to what degree were they hurt, and what did they do to monitor their credit, and what did they do to understand that they may be involved in and they're included in having their Social Security number taken, and how does it give direct injury? And, you know, really, Gary, when you start talking about it, individuals may have some claims, and these class action suits, I encourage anybody who has concern to look into them, but it could be a lot of other companies, like some of your credit card companies, that are going to be upset because some of the credit card companies guarantee against fraud for your credit card. So, you know, a company like Visa or MasterCard or Discover, somebody else, may be having thousands of people who are saying that's a fraud, that's stolen identity, that's in, and what do those credit card companies have to do? They end up wiping that off your bill. And when they wipe it off your bill, they, in essence, unless they can get back to the company who took the credit, the restaurant and the supermarket or the gas station that took the credit, they're the ones sitting there. And it could be the gas stations and the restaurants that end up losing money here, because they all, in essence, get charged back. And if they can't get charged back, then Discover eats the money. And that's where a lot of your losses are going to
be. But now you're talking about real financial harm. Some of the plaintiffs in the class action suit said we got financial harm because we had to go spend money. We had to spend money to protect our credit, to lock it down, et cetera. And so that's one reason the Equifax and their lawyers say we're going to give it to you for free. So we're going to take that argument away from you. And so now you don't have any pecuniary real harm. You got your credit stolen, your credit information stolen. But a question that looms, and we're going to go to the phones here in a minute, but a question that looms over, Can you maintain a cause of action? Have you been harmed just because all your private sensitive information was stolen? Not that you've suffered a credit loss yet, but just because it was stolen. Joining us live right now is Joan from Colorado Springs. Good morning, Joan. What can we do for you?
Good morning. I'm enjoying your show, and I have a 26-year-old son who I feel had some ADA rights violated.
Okay.
And this particular thing happened in Texas. He was trying to break up a fight between his girlfriend and her brother, and the brother faked that he was choking him and called the police. And he made, you know, his own scratches and red marks, and he was arrested. My son was arrested.
Okay, all right.
He is deaf. His girlfriend is deaf. He was arrested. He was booked. He was kept overnight in jail and went to a bail hearing without an interpreter.
And without, did he have an attorney?
No, not at that time.
No, not at that time. All right. And so, but did this fight or event or incident, did it take place in a workplace environment or did
no,
it take place
it was in a home?
In a home.
Yes. So
okay.
He was charged with a third-degree felony. He has been to court. His attorney felt, by the time they got to court, he had an attorney. And the attorney felt that it would be better for him to plead guilty to the act, but not trying to intentionally hurt him, because he felt he had a better chance at a deferred probation, which did happen.
Okay, well, sometimes, and let's just talk about it generally first, but sometimes in those situations, you look for what can you prove to prove your side of the case. And yes, he said, so this other person made up his own scratches, injured himself, called the police, etc. How can we prove it? So an attorney sometimes say, it's going to be better that you plead here or do this. It sometimes doesn't go to the truth of the matter. It sometimes goes to what can be really proved. And if you spend a lot of money trying to prove something you can't prove, that sometimes goes into the factor. Brad, your take on this?
Yeah, where is this in Harris County, down in Texas, or?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and
Abilene.
Okay, and you know there's been some cases out of Harris County, but you know with respect to it, I'm not so sure they've had any that have gone on with respect to somebody who's deaf and that kind of ADA. But, you know, when we're talking about it, you said he had to go to a bail hearing without an interpreter, without anybody to interpret or to talk to him, correct?
That is correct. The judge read him his rights or whatever they do in a court hearing and sent him back to the jail cell. And I think he had some afterthoughts about it because he called two deaf advocates in town to go talk to him, and my son knew the advocates.
Well, the judge should have had some second thoughts about it because
yes, I would think so.
Here's what happens, and what would have to be determined. First of all, your son should address it. And he should pursue, and there's attorneys out there, and if he needs help, we can find him some attorneys out there who should pursue the fact that he had to go through the bail hearing without, and the rights were read without him being able to hear him, and because he under disability.
Okay.
Once again, and something we've been talking about on our show is then the next thing we have to do is determine was your son harmed by any of the stuff that was going on. Obviously, the charges are being read. He doesn't know what the charges are. His bail's being explained. He doesn't know what the bail is. It delays him being able to get bail. It delays him being able to do anything. He's in jail a little bit longer. It sounds like the judge got on it pretty quick, which he should have. I know we have some judges listening here today, and I'm not asking them to call in, but I think most judges in our state would have said, okay, go sit over here in the jury box, unless it's way at 5 o'clock or something. They'd say, go sit over here in the jury box, and they would look at their staff and they'd say, get me an interpreter right now, and they'd require somebody to get there. And in our state, most of the judges in this county or in this area, I think, would have done that, and they would have gotten an interpreter there to explain everything.
Well, their interpreters, we did have interpreters for the two hearings that he had to go to Texas for, but they had to come from Dallas.
Okay, yeah.
And when I asked the attorney about that, he said it's prosecutorial discretion, and I didn't understand.
Wait a minute, what was he saying, Joan? What was he saying was prosecutorial discretion?
The fact that I was questioning the ADA rights.
Your son's attorney was saying that?
Yes. I think he wanted just didn't want to get into that end of it. He was successful in getting him the deferred probation, and his case is now in El Paso County.
Sure, but here's the thing that comes up, and you know, just quickly, if I'm in jail longer than I should be because I couldn't make bond because I didn't know how to, or I didn't know my rights to do it when they should have been read to me, then I've been kept in jail too long. And that's a cause of action. Now, there may not be a lot of money to it or a lot of rights, but it's something your son, for fellow deaf persons and people in the future, may want to address.
Uh-huh.
You know, let's get your number and talk to you a little bit off the air, if you don't mind.
All right. I would love to.
Okay, Joan, so we're going to break, but I'm going to put you on hold. If you give Kevin your information, we'll follow up with you and see if we can help you here.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you for the call. You're listening to the Bell and Pollock Legal Show, the only show of its kind, 303-713-8255. We talk law on this show for you. We'll be right back. Welcome to the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Gary Bell, Brad Pollock, our law firm is Bell and Pollock. We are injury attorneys, but this show is for you to answer your questions on any legal subject and to analyze legal subjects and to talk law. We're going to talk with Eric from Catlin's right now. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. How are you doing today?
Good.
Doing
what's
good,
cooking?
We got a couple more specials. We're running two new ones now this week. Our breakfast special is going to be a Denver omelet. We're going to showcase that for our breakfast special. Now, like you guys, I know you know what that is, but I'm going to go through it anyway. It's a two-egg omelet. We got diced ham, sautéed onions, sautéed bell peppers. You can put our scratch-made red or green chili on that. We make those right on the premises here. We're going to load that up with mixed cheese. You get a side of hash browns with that. You also get a choice of toast, flour, tortilla, or pancakes with that. I suggest the pancakes. They're buttermilk. They're scratch-made. They're out of this world. I suggest those. The lunch special is going to be a chili bowl. We also make that right here on the premises. That's going to be our homemade beans. We're going to top that with your choice of meat. You can get carne asada, carne adobada. Those are beef and pork, by the way. You can get chicken on that. You can get sautéed veggies on top of that, whatever you want. We're going to load mixed cheese on top of that, a little bit of sour cream. Again, the red or green chili is your choice on that. That also comes with the toast tortilla or the pancakes. Again, you've got to go with the pancakes with that. And then don't forget, guys, on Mondays and Fridays from 11 to 2, it's all-you-can-eat taco burrito buffet. It's all-you-can-eat. It's from 11 to 2. It's every Monday. It's every Friday. It's only $8.45. That's the price. It includes a non-alcoholic beverage in the price. You can't beat that. That's not enough. We got flat screens on. We got college football on. We got crafts and mimosas for $12.45. Everything's ready to go. Everything's hot and ready. So come on down this weekend and check us out.
Sounds great, Eric.
Absolutely.
That omelet, the green chili on that omelet is what makes it.
Absolutely, and you guys can get that in bulk, too. You know, we do a lot of that in bulk. You can get it hot, you can get it cold, you can get it frozen. We serve it all kinds of ways. You can take it home for your Denver Broncos tomorrow if you're doing something at home. All kinds of good ways to serve that up.
All right, Eric, where are you located?
We are 4379 East Mississippi Avenue. Now, that's one block east of Colorado Boulevard. That's the Glendale Shopping Center. Guys, come and check us out.
All right,
see you,
thanks
Eric.
A lot.
Thanks, guys.
Take care, buddy.
All right, the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We talk law on this show. Right now, we're going to talk to Rodeo Doc. Good morning, Rodeo Doc. How are you?
Well, good morning, gentlemen. I'm just fine. It's a glorious morning in southern Douglas County.
It's a glorious morning almost everywhere.
Indeed. I just wanted to touch on shoulder pain and car crashes, something that's aggravated me over the years in the way that insurance companies go. Well, you were hit from the rear end, you couldn't possibly have shoulder pain.
Right. I mean, they say when you're hit from the rear end, number one, nobody can believe this, but they blame it on you. You were rear-ended, and you were sitting at a stoplight, number one. Number two, you couldn't have been injured. And number three, the mechanism of injury doesn't connect with your complaint of shoulder pain. So let's talk about it.
Well, and that's kind of what I wanted to direct my comments to, is that sort of mechanism of injury. And it falls in two different parts for shoulder pain. The first one, and this one's a little more obvious, I think, is the direct injury, something that happens to your shoulder complements of the shoulder belts. In a side impact, it's pretty easy to see that the shoulder may well impact the B pillar, the side of a door, maybe even the window. Second form is the referred kind of problem that develops in shoulder pain and car crashes. This comes from referred pain, neck soft tissue, disc lesions, that kind of thing. And it's more prevalent than considered, and patients that are being told it can't be related need to understand that. Things like the 94 study in the Journal of Cephalgia found 53% of whiplash patients have shoulder disorders. That's a pretty high rate of occurrence. Another study found in 476 whiplash patients, they had a 9% occurrence of just the impingement type. And that was in the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. And finally, we'd looked at a British study in 2005, found that 15% of whiplash patients have MRI-confirmed acute shoulder injuries. And so this is pretty well established in the literature, I think, in that these patients shouldn't be just told that they're not having injuries that are related to the impact that happened to them.
You know, you're so right, and I tell you what, we're so passionate about a lot of these subjects, including that one, that we have decided to do an hour-long show in KOA every Saturday morning starting at 10 o'clock just on injury subjects. And we are going to get into these subjects like that. How can the insurance company say you didn't suffer shoulder pain? And if you did, it's only transient. And if you did, everybody should be over it in 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 2 weeks. But you're right on the money, and there's a lot of medical literature, as you say, rodeo doc, to back it up.
Well, that statement of you couldn't or you wouldn't or whatever, we understand that's avoidance by the insurance company. Don't want to pay for it. Don't want to hear about it. But the literature is pretty darn clear, and it's certainly something I've seen over and over and over in my patient group. And secondarily, I did want to tell you guys, congratulations on the new show. That's awesome.
Thanks.
Well, thank you very much.
The important part about that shoulder injury is to get in and get it treated. Do something about it. You know, if you start not using your shoulder, you don't do things with it, and next thing you know, your range of motion is decreasing, you're getting some frozen shoulder, you're having some problems with your shoulder, and next thing you know, it becomes even worse.
Well, that's absolutely true, and I've certainly seen that in a number of cases, and yeah, the treatment for a lot of it can be relatively simply addressed by some soft tissue and some manipulation, and the patient gets their shoulder back pain-free, and that's a great outcome in an injury situation.
Right. You got to get on it. That's the important part, Rodeo.
Hey, Rodeo Doc, we appreciate your call.
You bet. You guys have a blessed rest of your day.
All right. You too, buddy.
Thanks
Take
a
care.
Lot. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We're here for you. We're going to talk a lot with Dave. Good morning, Dave. How are you? Dave, are you there?
Dave or Steve?
Oh, I'm sorry. I've got the wrong name. Is this Steve then?
This is Steve.
I'm very sorry, Steve. What's going on?
I appreciate you accepting the call. In terms of federal rules of evidence, Rule 901, there's an addition that's effective on December 1st, and it says evidence that is self-authenticating. There were 11 sections, but now there's 13 and 14. So my question, you were talking about Equifax earlier.
Right.
How does this affect information from Equifax or if a guy's a dope dealer or information that's transferred between a patient and a doctor or my personal information? And also on this rule addition, is there a parallel Colorado State parallel rule addition? And if it is, do you have to acquire a search warrant for this electronic stuff?
Okay, so you've covered a lot of issues there. And you said Rule 901, but I think you meant 902, self-authenticating.
Yeah, 902. I'm
okay,
sorry.
Self-authenticating documents. And right. So to answer your question to begin with, yes, there's a federal rule. Yes, there's a Colorado rule. But those rules don't kick. Those are rules of evidence. Rules of evidence. And they don't really kick in or apply until you have a lawsuit. So you have a lawsuit, then you're talking about evidentiary matters, then you're talking about evidence, and then you talk about the rules of evidence, and Rule 902 is one of the rules of evidence. So pre-lawsuit, there's things that you can do, but let's put it in the right context. That's a lawsuit phenomena, and it's designed so that you can documents can be self-authenticated, and you don't have to call a million people to the stand to identify and authenticate this document, this one, this one, this one. So, but now you're talking about your own personal information and health information?
Well, that, or they're going into the electronic. I guess before they wouldn't admit electronic evidence, but now they're saying, the two additional new sections, it says generated by electronic process or system or copied from an electronic device, storage medium, or file. So now people can no longer hide evidence. But like Kushner's doing with the using a private email for White House business.
Okay, So we're just talking law here. We're not talking politics. So yeah. Right. So once again, that applies to a lawsuit, civil lawsuit type of situation. So if somebody's hiding evidence, and sometimes district attorneys get accused of hiding or losing exculpatory evidence, as an example, sometimes in civil lawsuits, maybe trucking companies don't turn over, or they hide, or they destroy evidence about the logbooks or the digital logbooks. Sometimes in a medical malpractice case, the records are changed or altered, that sort of thing. So yes, that's illegal, but that's all by virtue of a different law. Then you get into the lawsuits, and then can you discover these things? Yes, and then how do you prove them? One of the ways you prove them is through self-authentication.
Yeah, and what you're talking about is how you take this electronic evidence and you make it authenticated. And actually, you're talking about both rules 901 and 902, because 901 also addresses digital evidence. As a matter of fact, that 901b4, it permits the authentication of digital evidence by distinctive characteristics or circumstances. They look at the appearance, the contents, the substance. They're going to talk about the internal patterns or other distinctive characteristics. In something like this, this is a whole new world that you're talking about as far as what's going to happen with self-authentication or authentication of documents or digital evidence. And what they've gotten in that 901 also has another section, B9, that talks about how they're going to be able to authenticate this without having to go through a huge amount of authentication, but it's still going to require right now an IT person who can get in and show that the pattern shows this authentic and it actually comes from the source that is being claimed.
Steve, we got to go to break. Can you hold on with us till the other side of the break?
I can hold on.
All right, we appreciate your call. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Don't forget, 2 weeks from today, October 14th, we're going to start airing and launch a new injury show on KOA, 10 o'clock in the morning, Saturday mornings, KOA, 8:50 a.m. We're going to cover injury law. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome to all of our stations, all of our listeners. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Don't forget about the show that follows our show, the Consumer Real Estate Show. Barry and Larry, they are very knowledgeable. I listen to them. They always talk about interesting subjects. They always know what they're talking about. They're very professional. They're the show that follows our show. Right before the break, we were talking to Steve about Rule 901, 902, self-authentication of digital evidence in court. Steve, you still with us?
I'm still there. I have a third part of my question, last part. Let's say the insurance company is challenging my medical condition, so they request 5 years of medical records.
Right.
Now, you've got the IT person that goes into these third parties. Does that cross over into Rule 802, 803 on hearsay?
Well, it could, but it may meet a hearsay exception, but I'm not certain what you're talking about. When the insurance company wants the information about your medical records, all right, and gets the medical information that it has, which you're saying is whatever the doctor put in or the nurse put in, should be talking about an 803 or an 802 hearsay.
Past doctors. Let's say I had an accident in 2016.
Okay.
Now they want to dig back to 2008 to see if anything, there was a pre-existing something.
And what you're going to find very interesting about this, first thing the insurance company is going to do is they're going to ask you about it. And that when they come in and say, did you have this problem? Then they're going to say the medical records should be admitted. And that's another place where we start talking about whether or not you've authenticated the medical records and whether they have any essence of reliability. We've talked about this many times. So when you're talking 801 hearsay, and then you talk 803, an exception for the medical records, which can be authenticated. There's a way to do it through a proper document that where people say these are the medical records. Now they can be admitted, but you still have the right to say, well, wait a minute, that's the statement of a doctor or a nurse from 5, 6, 7 years ago, and they may be right, they may be wrong. But that evidence is going to come in because it clears the hearsay exception. Okay? So, you know, now you're talking about do you have to have any kind of 902 or 901, and this is going to be confusing to people listening, but 901 and 902, self-authentication or authentication of all of the actual computer electronic evidence.
Right. But the bottom line is this: if you are injured and they want 5 years or 6 years or 7 years of records, and they always want records forever, and they don't think 5 years is enough, and they don't think 10 years is enough, pre-lawsuit, they can't go get those records by themselves, but you have to give them permission, you have to give them release, or you have to turn the records over to them with an appropriate privilege lock. That's number one. Number two, once you get into a lawsuit, then the rules of evidence, hearsay rules, apply. And they want to introduce your records from 2008 into your lawsuit, into your claim, to prove that you told the nurse or the doctor that you really didn't have any problems, this and that. And so that's trying to get the medical record into evidence to use it against you on your injury claim in the lawsuit and trial.
If it's a report by a doctor or a nurse and they're not actually there in the courtroom, that becomes hearsay?
No, it becomes a business record exception, and it can be argued to be hearsay, but usually it's admitted into evidence. Where the rub comes in is people tell us all the time, well, I saw a doctor in 2009, I saw a doctor in 2012, but I never told them that's in the record. Do you ever go read your medical records when you go see the doctor? No, you don't. You don't get your records, but when you have a lawsuit, you get your records. And a lot of people says, I never told them that. I never had that condition. That's wrong. That medical record's wrong. And then what the insurance company attorneys try to do to you is make you look stupid in court because you're now saying a medical record, a sacrosanct medical record is wrong. It's an error. So you must be not telling the truth, Steve. That's how it works.
A business record would be like daily documentation by the doctor.
Yeah, but an examination. I examined Steve. He said the following. He said this and that. He said he never was injured. He said he had a back problem. And so... So, is that record kept in the ordinary course of business? Yes. Is it the ordinary course of business of that doctor and that medical office to keep those records? Yes, probably coming into evidence.
Right. It's probably going to get into evidence. The question is its reliability, seeing it. And the reason you have exceptions to the hearsay rules, they talk about whether or not there is some kind of reliability. And one of the rules, the 803 exception, is subparagraph 4, but it says a statement made for medical diagnosis or treatment. And that's what they're saying. That should have special reliability of accuracy. It doesn't, but all that does is clear the hurdle of coming in. It doesn't make it accurate. It does put a stigma on being able to say that's not accurate, that didn't really happen. So if a doctor says 5 years ago you broke a bone and he puts it in a record, he or she puts it in a record, you may be fighting long and hard to prove that really isn't true. That didn't happen, because it does come into evidence, and then you've got a jury who can weigh, okay, I've got a doctor 5 years ago saying you broke a bone. You're saying you didn't. You have everything to gain by having that bone not be broken 5 years ago. I don't know who I'm going to believe. And don't try and get the doctor or the medical professional who put it in there to come in, because they're not going to remember 5 years ago whether or not that bone was
broken. Well, they're not going to say the record 5 years ago is erroneous. And the classic example is you're injured in a car accident. You got a back problem in the car accident. And the insurance company finds out a record 5 years earlier where you said you had the same back problem. But you say, no, I really didn't 5 years ago. But the insurance company says it's in the medical records. And so the records come into evidence. And if you get the doctor or the nurse, they're not going to say, no, I was mistaken 5 years ago. So the record becomes the Bible. The record becomes the sacrosanct evidence against you. And that's how they try to use these records.
So they become expert witnesses. Is that correct?
In a long way, in a major way.
In
yes.
essence, yes. Some really yes. great questions, Steve. You really yeah. do.
And now you've just brought in Rule 702. So you've just covered the sevens, the eights, and the nines.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to be an evidence teacher?
you're
I just want to be sure.
You want to be sure? Yeah, well.
They got my records, and I can request my attorney to review those records before they're released to the at-fault.
Absolutely.
Well, sure.
And the case is Alcon versus Spicer, and your attorney can review them, and everything that's not relevant to your injury claim right now can be protected and not turned over.
And it doesn't hurt every now and then when your doctor's keeping reporting, especially if you have a doctor a long time or doing special care, say, can I see the records you're writing? Can I see what you're writing? And if you don't agree with it, tell the doctor you don't agree.
Okay.
Say, wait a minute, this is an error. Doctors a lot of times dictate these things, and then at the end of the day, they're put into the different files. And
the case you quoted was Alcon versus
Alcon versus Spicer, Alcon versus Spicer. I don't have the site right now, but that's a seminal case. And there was also the Weil versus City of Dillon case at the same time.
Okay.
All right, Steve.
That's what I needed to know. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Steve. Appreciate the call.
113 Pacific 3rd, 735 on Alcon versus
Rock
Spicer.
Rock and roll, Brad.
113 Pacific
113
Pacific 3rd, 735.
735. Thank you.
You bet.
You're welcome, Steve. Thanks for the calls. Dale, we're sorry we couldn't get to you. Chris, we're sorry. If you want to leave your number, we'll be glad to call you during the week. And if you want to call back on next week's show, we'll be glad to address it then. Don't forget about Bell and Pollock's new show. It's an injury show. It's going to launch October 14th, Saturday. It's going to be every Saturday, KOA, 10 o'clock in the morning. It's going to be the definitive show on injury law, injury questions, injury issues, insurance issues. Be sure to listen to it. Launches October 14th. Our website, championsofthepeople.com. We'll see you next week. But man, I never will forget the way the moonlight shined upon her head.